We got information about some secret talks for months, but we trusted people. We might be naive, but for me, it's always better to be naive than to be a liar. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's so immoral, everything that happened, that it's hard to believe. But obviously, in football, everything is possible.
That is the voice of Alexander Seferin, president of UEFA, the Union of European Football Associations, reacting the way billions of people have to the nascent European Super League. From players and fans to heads of state and actual royalty, rarely has an announcement provoked such anger and such opposition, seemingly unified all around the world. Today, Sam Borden breaks down the story that sent shockwaves across several continents, and he explains what happens to the world's most popular sport from here. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, April 20th. This is ESPN Day. Sam Borden, thank you for joining me, man.
Absolutely. Glad to be here, Pablo.
Sam Borden is a global sports correspondent for ESPN. There's a lot to get to today. I mean, we're talking about seismic news, Sam, in the world of soccer that broke on Sunday when something called the European Super League got announced. And I'm no expert in the way that you are, but from what I can tell, the entire continent of Europe is furious, along with like 4 billion other soccer fans all around the planet. And when I say furious, Sam, I mean really, really, really intergalactically pissed off about this. And I don't truly understand what's happening. So I needed to talk to you as someone who has spent years living in Europe covering soccer there to just explain it to an ignorant American like me, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely, Pablo. I think the best place to start is to say that remember how upset everybody in college football was about the BCS? Then like multiply that by about 100. And I think you're starting to approach the reaction that like most of the soccer world is having to this concept.
So let's start super simple here. What exactly got announced on Sunday?
Okay, so what was announced on Sunday was the formation of this new league. They're calling it the European Super League. And it's going to be made up of the biggest teams in European soccer. We've got AC Milan, Arsenal, Atletico Madrid, Chelsea, Barcelona, Inter, Juventus, Liverpool, Man City, Man United, Real Madrid, Tottenham Hotspur. I mean, these are sort of like the New York Yankees and Dallas Cowboys of European soccer. And because European soccer is sort of the center of the soccer universe, these are the biggest teams in the world. And what they announced was instead of playing in their domestic leagues, the English teams playing most of their games in England, and then occasionally playing against other European teams in the Champions League, what they're going to do is really play a ton more games against these other big teams. They're still going to have some games in their home countries, but the center of their schedule is going to be based around playing against only these bigger teams.
So basically, these crown jewel franchises, this Justice League of soccer, as they may see themselves, it turns out, they are going to go and succeed and do their own thing. That seems like self-evidently an enormous deal, but I also understand that they're doing this to compete directly with UEFA, the Champions League. And remind me what the Champions League is again and how it fits into this whole dynamic.
No, for sure. It's super confusing. A lot of times people look at like a European soccer team's, you know, schedule of games and can't keep track of exactly what competition they're playing in. It's not exactly the same as it is in America. So what happens essentially is Barcelona or AC Milan, they play in their domestic league. They, you know, Barcelona plays in La Liga, AC Milan plays in Serie A, the Italian league or the Spanish league. And the Champions League is a European model where the most successful teams in each of these domestic leagues then play a separate tournament against the other most successful teams. And it changes from year to year. The only way to get into the Champions League is to be one of the best teams in the domestic league. And so what this model is essentially challenging that. Instead of the Champions League existing as a meritocracy. The top three or four teams from England get to play in this. What's going to happen is the center of that league is going to be made up of always these bigger teams, even if they have a bad year, even if Barcelona has a bad year in La Liga, they're still going to be guaranteed a spot in this Super League. And in the Champions League model, that wasn't guaranteed.
But it's just funny because the Champions League, Sam, I mean, it's nothing to sneeze at, right? Like, this is the most watched annual sporting event in the world as it is now.
100%. It's one of those things people often will ask me, oh, like, what's a bigger deal, the Super Bowl or the Champions League final? When I laugh, they assume that I'm going to say, oh, the Super Bowl. But I'm laughing because it's actually the reverse. The Super Bowl does really well, no doubt, but it's not even in the same stratosphere. I think what is rubbing many people the wrong way about this is that the Champions League is pretty great, is pretty big as it is right now. And this group of teams is essentially trying to make it irrelevant.
So this Justice League, or at least that's how they see themselves, why do they want to risk being seen as like the Legion of Doom now? Why do they want to become villains and heel turn against the Champions League? Like, what's at stake here? Why break away from something so profitable?
Well, geez, I don't know, Pablo. What do you think? Let's talk about professional sports and the reason why anything happens. What do you think it might be? Oh, it's money, of course. That's exactly what it is. During this pandemic, like everybody, a lot of these teams have lost a lot of money. They've lost a lot of games where fans would be in the stands. They've had sponsorship deals dry up. They've had to go through the sort of cost cutting that everybody has during the pandemic. But the truth is, this idea predates the pandemic by many years. This is something that big clubs have been talking about for a very long time, because the truth is, in European soccer, the biggest teams bring in the bulk of the revenue. And as it stands right now, those bigger clubs, they keep plenty of that money. But a lot of that money is funneled into domestic soccer associations, smaller clubs. And while I think most people would say, sure, they owe some measure of revenue to help the sport as a whole, the bottom line is those teams look at the situation and say, hey, most people want to watch us play. Why aren't we keeping even more of the money that we're bringing in? They feel that if they run this competition themselves, they can keep more of the money and they can guarantee that they're going to be involved year after year. So when you look at it from that perspective, from a business standpoint, it's not difficult at all to figure out what exactly is driving the bus here.
So to translate here, Sam, it's basically like if Ohio State got super upset that they're the biggest draw in the Big Ten, but they still have to split the revenue with like the 13 other teams, which includes, say, Rutgers.
That's exactly what it's like. These teams are saying, now, hang on a minute. I'm Barcelona. I've got Messi. Everybody wants to watch me play. Why, again, am I giving a ton of my money to a team that nobody's ever heard of from Norway? Why are they getting so much out of my pocket? And the truth is, if you're the owner of Barcelona, or if you're the owner of Arsenal or Man United, that question is difficult to answer, right? It's the same problem that we see here in America when you have these haves and have-nots. The difference is that in America, we have a central structure for most of our sports organizations. Mm. Whereas in Europe, you're talking about multiple leagues, multiple governments, multiple governing bodies. And so those teams are looking at it and saying, hang on, we're making most of this pie. Why are we giving away so much of it?
So I want to understand where these haves are gonna get more. Like, where are they gonna get this money from in terms of starting out and funding this whole enterprise?
For sure. And I think it's important to understand the figures that we're dealing with. You know, American Bank, JP Morgan, they're involved in this from the start. And by the way, probably not coincidentally, Ed Woodward, who is the head of Manchester United, he used to be at JP Morgan. Mm. So it's not stunning here that this is the bank that's involved. They're talking about $6 billion in loans. Each team's going to get about $400 million to start out. And then obviously they're going to get a lot more than that through TV rights, marketing rights, global distribution. The idea is that that is literally just the starting point. And to put that into perspective, 400 million, that's more than four times what the winning team in the Champions League got last year. So for sure, the Champions League is big deal, big business. But what we're talking about here is 4x that. You can see when you consider those figures why these teams are willing to play ball with such a controversial idea.
Okay, so I get why the business is so towering, why the stakes are so large, but I still don't fully get the reaction and how widespread it's been and how strong it's been, because it seems like pretty much everybody is against this thing, Sam. We're talking about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out and saying he firmly opposes this.
I don't think that it is good news for fans. I don't think it's good news for football in this country. I don't like the look of these proposals, and we'll be consulting about what we can do.
We're talking about Prince William and Kate Middleton on Twitter coming out in opposition, although that tweet was apparently signed W, so maybe that's a William thing more than a Kate thing. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, is also against this. UEFA themselves, their president, Alexander Seferin, came out in very strong terms against this yesterday.
I cannot stress more strongly at this moment, UEFA and the footballing world stand united against the disgraceful, self-serving proposal we have seen in the last 24 hours from a select few clubs in Europe.
And then, Sam, you look at the actual stadiums, like on the ground, all of these fans, all the fans of these potential Super League teams themselves, they seem to have come out against it. You see signs that are homemade at the stadiums for Man United, for Liverpool, and one of the signs says, created by the poor, stolen by the rich. Another one says, shame on you. There seems to be this whole populist undercurrent here. So why is the reaction so universally negative?
You know, I think it's a couple of things, Pablo. I think the first thing is that soccer is built on tradition, and this is a change from tradition. This is a devaluing of the domestic leagues. You know, if you're a soccer fan in England, you grow up dreaming of your team winning the Premier League, winning the top division, beating all the other English teams. The Champions League came along, it's become a big deal, but at its core, the domestic leagues are still the heartbeat of soccer around the world. And so I think that the knock-on effect from this Super League is that everything else below it is going to be devalued. Those teams like Man United, like Liverpool, like Man City might not be able to participate in the domestic league anymore if they go and play in the Super League. And even if they do, even if they are able to work out a way for them to participate, they're not going to play their best players. Why would you play your best player against Stoke in an English league game that's, you know, that's not worth nearly as much as the game you have against Barcelona 4 days later? So the devaluing, I think, is a big part of it. And I think the other thing is that the central premise of this Super League is that these teams, these 12, 15 teams, are going to be a part of this league, good or bad, year after year. And the meritocracy component of soccer around the world is supposed to be, are you good enough to play here? And if you're good enough to be the best, then you move up a level. And if you're not the best and you're among the worst, then you go down a level. And what this does is get rid of that. This says, okay, the way you make it into this league is to be one of the biggest names, to have the most money. And that runs completely against the idea that in soccer, you have to win your way in.
All right, Sam, after the break, I need to understand how fans and how governments and how the rest of the soccer world, how they're all fighting back, and whether they might actually be able to stop this Super League of Doom.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
All right, Sam. So it seems like nothing has united all of Europe ever so much as everyone hating on this new European Super League. Can anything actually be done to slow it down and even to stop it?
Yeah, Pablo. I mean, there are a couple of different ways this thing could go. It seems like, as you said before, the backlash already is massive. And we're seeing some threats for tangible action. UEFA is threatening to ban any of these breakaway clubs from this year's Champions League, which is happening right now and is in the semifinals. Real Madrid, Man City, Chelsea, hypothetically, they could be removed and we could be congratulating Paris Saint-Germain, who would be the winner by default, I guess, if those three.
Wait. So three of the four teams right now in the semifinal would be in the Super League. So PSG could just be handed the trophy out of like some mixture of virtue and spite.
Yeah, I guess hypothetically that's possible. Although, I mean, it's also particularly funny because PSG will almost surely be in the Super League eventually. They just haven't said yet that they will be. So I don't know. Maybe that's a strategic play on their part. They're thinking there's a chance they might get this year's Champions League trophy without having to break a sweat.
Oh, that would be brilliant and diabolical.
That would be a very sharp move. So that's one thing. I don't know that that's going to happen. That seems unlikely to me. We've also got the domestic associations. They're looking to get involved and take action too. There's a meeting set for today among the remaining Premier League clubs trying to decide what to do. And like we talked about before, you could see a scenario where they say, hang on, you can't play in this league with us. You're going to have even more of a financial advantage than you already do if you're playing in this league that's talking about $400 million just for showing up. So there is the possibility that we could have a Premier League without Liverpool or Man City or Man United. All of these things are on the table, but it remains to be seen exactly what is legally feasible for any of them.
But to throw out Man United and Liverpool out of the Premier League, I mean, again, translating here to American audience, that's like throwing at the Yankees out of baseball. That's like throwing the Yankees out of baseball or the Cowboys out of the NFL. Is that actually a thing they can do?
I mean, maybe. It seems really unlikely to me, I think, ultimately, Pablo, because as we said at the beginning, those teams are the big money makers. I think ultimately the rest of the Premier League, for example, would rather figure out a way to keep, you know, Man United, Man City, Liverpool, these teams that bring in all the money. They'd rather figure out a way to keep them in their league than kick them out. But I think ultimately one of the things that's going to be the biggest determining factors in what happens to this Super League is how FIFA and UEFA respond. UEFA and FIFA are these sort of larger governing bodies. FIFA basically runs the sport. And what they've said is that their rules indicate that if a player is participating in a league that's not sanctioned, if they're in a breakaway league like this one is being made out to be, they could be banned from playing in international competitions. They could be banned from playing in the Euros, for example, or the World Cup. So you could have a situation where Cristiano Ronaldo, who plays for Juventus, plays in this Super League with Juventus, but then can't play for Portugal in the Euros or the World Cup. Can you imagine that? You'd have these big stars who are playing these massive club games, but when it comes time to be a part of the biggest tournament in the world, in the World Cup, they're at home.
I mean, holy crap, Sam. Like, the idea that Messi, Pulisic, like, that these guys might not be able to play in World Cups. I do know that a World Cup matters so much. What would the players do in that case?
I think ultimately, that's why I say, in my opinion, that's going to be the determining factor. If, in fact, that is the stance that FIFA takes, and I am sure that they will get plenty of pushback from the clubs and the players on it, but if that's the path they decide to go, I think that will be the breaking point. But I also know that FIFA and UEFA understand that, hey, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, these are the guys that are the stars that make the World Cup and the Euros and the Copa America, for example. These are the guys that make those tournaments a big deal. So they don't want to have a situation where they're saying, no, you can't play either. Ultimately, everybody benefits if the biggest teams and the biggest players participate. So really, it's going to end up being a massive game of chicken between clubs, players, and the governing bodies over who's going to blink first and who's going to back down from what they're trying to make happen.
So as for the timing of all of this unfolding, Sam, why is this happening right now?
So the reason it happened on Sunday night, after having been talked about for years, is that on Monday, UEFA announced changes to the Champions League. Remember, the Champions League we talked about earlier is the continental competition. The final is bigger than the Super Bowl. UEFA had been working on changes to the Champions League to try to address some of these concerns, like to try to give a little bit of a bigger piece of the pie to some of the bigger teams, and also to make it slightly bigger than what it is right now, to bring in some more teams to be a part of it so that they would be able to reap the financial benefits. UEFA had planned to announce those reforms on Monday, so the Super League wanted to kind of get out in front of that, and that's why they announced on Sunday night.
So I'm looking at this list of teams again that would join the Super League, and conspicuously absent is last year's winner of the Champions League, Bayern Munich, and they're a perennial powerhouse, a global powerhouse. Why is it that they and no other German teams as of right now, why they've decided not to join?
Bayern Munich obviously is one of the biggest teams in the world, and they are very conspicuous in their absence. And I think that it's interesting because when you look at German soccer, the German Bundesliga, they have a slightly different structure than many of the other leagues in Europe. German ownership rules require that every club in Germany be owned at least 51% by the fans. So sure, there is corporate backing behind all of these clubs, but none of them have a majority stake. And so any big time decision by the club has to be approved by at least that 51%. And so, as you noted earlier, the reaction to this concept has been pretty universally negative. And a lot of that is coming from fans. And so I think my understanding is that Bayern Munich is hesitant to say, hey, yeah, we're on board, because they don't know that they have the votes. If they brought this to a vote of their membership, they might not have enough support to go ahead and leave the Bundesliga.
So it feels like if this were a bottom-up dynamic, this may not have ever happened. But top-down, it seems like some stuff has been happening in secret. Have the owners of these teams just been negotiating in secret this whole time? How much of this comes out of nowhere?
Yeah, pretty much they've been negotiating in secret this whole time, like you said, Pablo. I mean, at his press conference the other day, Alexander Seferin, the head of UEFA, he didn't pull any punches.
So it's hard to believe the level of immorality of some people. So we have what we have, and football will not be sold to, I call them, dirty dozen.
He called many of the executives at these bigger clubs bald-faced liars, called them greedy.
We were always thinking, where are they hiding? We heard rumors about this and that. And, you know, now we know. There are 12 people who don't care about anybody else, who think they can get even more money, and they are already unbelievably rich.
As recently as a few days before the announcement of this Super League, Seferin was talking with Andrea Agnelli, who runs Juventus. I mean, this is a guy who's at the heart of this Super League. And 3 days before this announcement, he was talking to Seferin about how much he appreciated the changes in this new Champions League. He basically lied straight to his face. 3 days later, he's announcing this whole new thing that's going to compete with the Champions League. So, yeah, I mean, I think this concept has been bubbling beneath the surface for years, and it finally boiled this weekend.
I was going to say, Sam, how much this makes so much of what we talk about here in America, small potatoes. But the other thing that I'm noticing is that so many of these teams in this hypothetical Super League, and in the UK especially, there are American owners involved. Stan Kroenke, the owner of the Rams, also owns Arsenal. The Glazer family, who owns the Super Bowl-winning Tampa Bay Bucks, they own Man United. Fenway Sports Group, the owner of the Red Sox, they own Liverpool. How much of this entire dynamic here has to do with the influence of Americans?
I think it's fair to say that it has a significant part, but it's not just Americans. Foreign ownership is the majority in England in the Premier League. It's like 14 of the 20 teams are owned by non-English owners. And so that makes something like this inevitable. Those owners, they don't care about English football history. It's not their history. They bought these teams because they're moneymakers. They want success. They want global appeal. They want brand awareness. And so they're in it for the money. And this makes getting money easier and more guaranteed. I think it's important to understand, too, that this concept of a breakaway league, that's what the Premier League was. The Premier League began in the early 90s. It was essentially a group of the most successful teams in the old English First Division saying, hey, you know, we need to get together and keep more of this money for ourselves. So the history here, I mean, there's a lot of outrage, understandably, particularly from English fans. But the history here is that this is what happens. As you said, the top bring in the most amount of money. And at some point, people look around and say, why are we giving so much of this away? And so a generation ago, that led to the formation of the Premier League. And a generation later, we're talking about something else. Sports is entertainment. We're in an entertainment content business. And if you have the best players and the best teams, of course you want them to play more often.
So if you're going to gaze into your crystal ball here for a second, Sam, what do you think happens next?
I think there's going to be a lot more backlash. I think there's going to be a lot more discussion. And I think ultimately, Pablo, in the next few years, we're going to see a Super League of some kind. I think there is too much money in it for it to be ignored. I think that it's possible that that might be a revamping of the Champions League. Maybe the way that this ends up getting resolved and making UEFA happy is that the structure of the Champions League is changed dramatically, but the Champions League itself remains. But I think the idea that we're only going to see Barcelona play Man United a couple of times a year, I think that's going to go by the wayside. It just doesn't make sense. Ultimately, sports is an entertainment business. And if you have these big time entities, they need to be playing against each other more often and on TV all the time. And I think that's where we're headed.
But Sam, how do you square all of that capitalism with what seems to be all of this fury from people who say right now that they don't want that?
You know, I think, Pablo, you and I both know that there is no hysteria quite like sports hysteria. And we have seen this so many times in the past. I remember the backlash when interleague play in baseball came up. The idea that, oh, the Mets and the Yankees are going to play every year? What? This is, you know, the American League, the National League, this is an atrocity, right? But the bottom line is that there was too much money to be made in having those teams play against each other more often, in making the league bigger and having the biggest teams play each other more often. And so I think that for sure, right now there is a hysteria. This feels like the worst idea in the world. And a lot of people are coming out against it. But I think ultimately they will find a way to tamp down these issues, to make people feel as though some measure of the romance that comes with global soccer will exist, but also find a way to cash those checks as they've done in pro sports for, what, decades at this point? And I think that in the end, yes, there is a hysteria right now, but it will ultimately abate and people will be happy to watch the best players and the best teams playing against each other more often.
Sam Borden, thank you for explaining the world to me on ESPN Daily.
Pablo, anytime, buddy.
Okay, coming up, how none other than Gary Payton is sparking change.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Gary Payton is more than just loud. Gary Payton is strong. Gary Payton is intense. The kind of Hall of Famer that doesn't just make you laugh uncontrollably, but also puts clamps on the cockiest of rookies, luring them in, locking them down, sometimes leaving you unable to even move. But none of those qualities is why Gary Payton, the strain of legal marijuana I just described for you, was named in honor of the All-NBA point guard who retired in 2007 after meeting all of those descriptions on the court, right down to the giggles.
The glove will talk smack to anybody. We'll talk about your mother. We'll talk about your father. We'll talk about your kid.
Activate that one out of here, boy.
But in the world of cannabis, Gary Payton was slightly more cautious. He only gifted his name, image, and likeness to this specific strain after having lunch with a man named Burner, who is both a rapper and the founder of a reportedly nine-figure cannabis company called Cookies in the Bay Area, where Payton happens to be from. Bootleggers around Oakland had already started printing up fake packages after hearing Burner informally refer to his promising new hybrid, phenotype number 20, as Gary Payton, on account of Payton's number 20 jersey with the Sonics. But now Burner wanted to officially give a local legend his flower.
And I said, look, I want to put you in a bag like a Wheaties box. And so out of nowhere, Gary Payton has the best weed on the market right now.
In fact, those miniature Wheaties-style boxes of Gary Payton are still selling out as soon as they hit legal shelves all around California, despite costing about $70 for an eighth of an ounce. And the same also happens to be true for a competing hybrid from a different company, which made a strain named Number 33, which now comes in a bag printed with a jersey in Bulls red and the autograph of Chicago's Number 33 himself. Forget a signature sneaker, journalist Zach Harris, who covers the cannabis industry, told me. The future is in signature strains. But some part of Gary Payton does remain cautious, even today, on 420, and even as recreational marijuana is now legal or decriminalized in more than half of these United States and counting. Because for all the similarities between the man and his flower, there is one enormous distinction. Gary Payton doesn't smoke. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.